Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Canada's top investigative consumer program has helped you avoid clever scams, uncovered unsafe products, and exposed sketchy services. It returns to help keep you safe and save you money. CBC Marketplace has got your back. Watch free on CBC Gem.
I was one of many people that were victims who was used by somebody who was psychopathic.
Let's tell this story.
World of Secrets, Season 2, The Disciples. Listen now wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Janet Jalil, and in the early hours of Wednesday, the 10th of January, these are our main stories. Armed men who stormed a live TV program in Ecuador have reportedly been captured. A court in Washington has heard legal arguments on whether Donald Trump has immunity from charges of election fraud. Police in Poland have detained a former interior minister and his deputy who'd been seeking shelter in the presidential palace. Also in this podcast... One of the greats of Indian classical music, Rashid Khan, has died at the age of 55. We begin in Ecuador. Where gunmen wearing hoods stormed onto a live TV set on Tuesday and threatened staff. They were forced to lie on the floor before the live television feed was abruptly cut. A short time later, police entered the studio. They now say they've contained the situation. This all happened a day after the Ecuadorian president declared a nationwide state of emergency. This was in response to the prison escape of a gang leader on Sunday and a spate of riots in Ecuadorian jails, which erupted soon after. I asked our America's regional editor, Leonardo Rocha, if all the gunmen at the TV station had now been arrested.
That's what the police said, and they have released pictures and videos. They were arrested in Guayaquil, the city of Guayaquil, and there are 13 gang members, some of them quite young. Police said they also seized with them guns, pistols, bigger weapons, grenades, and also several dynamite sticks that they appear on TV. At some stage, they put one of those sticks in the breast pocket of the TV presenter.
And what do we know about these gunmen and how this incident relates to all the prison riots that we're seeing right now in Ecuador?
What happened is today there was a day of retaliation because of the state of emergency. This gang leader escaped on Sunday from a maximum security jail in Guayaquil. And then on the day after, there was another prison riot, and the president declared a state of emergency for 60 days in an overnight curfew. And what's clearly happened is that the several gangs, there's about 20 gangs in Ecuador, two of them are the big ones, but they attacked police officers, they kidnapped police officers, they attacked schools, they robbed shopping centers, and they carried out this attack against the TV station, TV station. And the clear message was that they are not going to accept that. I have to remember that President Daniel Noboa is quite young. He came into power in November, promising exactly that, to tackle organized crime. And he accused previous governments of just doing nothing about it, about this surge in violence.
But this poses a severe challenge for him, doesn't it?
Yes, this was a shocking day, even by what Ecuadorians have become accustomed to in the past 6-7 years. This is a huge challenge. Some people criticized him, saying that when he declared a state of emergency, they should know that there would be retaliation. They should have asked people to stay at home, but they didn't. But the main thing is the population seems to be behind him and say there is time to stop and to avoid it becoming an unsolvable problem.
Leonardo Rocha. A landmark legal case about whether Donald Trump should be immune from criminal prosecution has been heard in Washington. Mr. Trump is arguing that he has presidential immunity from criminal charges of conspiring to overthrow the 2020 election. Speaking after the hearing, he said finding against him would open a Pandora's box and unleash bedlam. But as our North America editor Sarah Smith reports, judges questioned whether such immunity would allow a president to assassinate a political rival.
Lawyers for Donald Trump argued in court that the Constitution protects former presidents from prosecution for actions taken in office. So does that mean an American president could order the murder of a political rival and avoid a criminal prosecution? Yes, according to Donald Trump's lawyer, who claimed that hypothetically former presidents cannot be prosecuted unless they've already been impeached and convicted in Congress. The three judges hearing this case sounded sceptical about Mr. Trump's claims to total immunity. The prosecution argued that his attempts to interfere with the election results were not official presidential acts and so not protected by the Constitution, and described the idea that former presidents could escape prosecution for assassinating rivals as a frightening thought. Donald Trump spoke outside the court after the hearing.
A president has to have immunity. And the other thing is, I did nothing wrong. We did nothing wrong.
Mr. Trump chose to appear in person today. He did not need to be in court. But he's made his efforts to fight his various criminal prosecutions central to his political campaign for re-election. Whatever the ruling from this case, it will almost certainly be appealed to the Supreme Court to make a definitive decision about whether or not Mr. Trump has immunity.
Sarah Smith. The US Secretary of State has said Palestinians in northern Gaza must be allowed to return home as soon as conditions allow, now that fighting there has eased. Speaking in Tel Aviv, Antony Blinken insisted that although Israel had Washington's resolute backing, civilian deaths in Gaza were far too high. He also said all the countries he visited on his Middle East tour saw the creation of an independent Palestinian state as vital for long-term peace. But he wouldn't be drawn on whether Israel backs this. Wira Davies reports from Jerusalem.
After a meeting with the entire Israeli war cabinet in Tel Aviv, a statement from the American side said that Antony Blinken had reaffirmed US support for Israel's right to prevent a repetition of the October 7th attacks, when heavily armed Hamas gunmen broke through the Gaza fence and killed 1,200 people in Israel. But in separate meetings with a succession of Israeli leaders, Mr. Blinken also emphasised what was described as the urgent need to protect civilian lives and accelerate the delivery of aid to Palestinians in Gaza. More than 100 people are reported to have been killed in Israeli airstrikes in Gaza over the last day, according to the Hamas-run health ministry. That brings the total number of victims to more than 23,000. And Mr. Blinken has had plenty of growing anger on this mammoth tour from regional leaders over the worsening humanitarian situation in Gaza.
In today's meetings, I was also crystal clear. Palestinian civilians must be able to return home as soon as conditions allow. They must not be pressed to leave Gaza. As I told the Prime Minister, the United States unequivocally rejects any proposals advocating for the resettlement of Palestinians outside of Gaza. And the Prime Minister reaffirmed to me today that this is not the policy of Israel's government.
Saudi Arabia's ambassador to the UK, Khalid bin Bandar Al Saud, says his country wants world leaders to treat Israel the same way they treat everyone else.
If anyone else had done what the Israelis are doing today, you would have seen them cut off from the international community. You would have seen people talking about sanctions. You would have seen all sorts of things. I just don't see that fair behavior. And the blind spot towards Israel is a real problem because it provides a blind spot to the peace. And, you know, like a lot of things that are linked, we will find no justice for the Palestinians if we don't find justice with the Israelis.
Despite that growing criticism and Washington's concern over the possibility of an expanding regional conflict between Israel and Hezbollah in Lebanon, Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu remains insistent that his army's operation in Gaza will not end until all of Israel's war goals are met.
Wira Davies. Well, even as the conflict in Gaza continues, one couple there have refused to let the war stop them getting married. Ella Bicknell reports.
Majid and Sarah got engaged a year ago and were due to get married in November. But the day before the ceremony, Ashal destroyed their newly renovated flat in the neighbourhood of Sheikh Izzaldin.
I had everything for my apartment, a TV, a washing machine, a sofa set, carpets and curtains, as well as a fully equipped kitchen. It was completely destroyed and we were picked up from under the rubble.
By God, I can't forget how much time I spent preparing everything for my wedding. I was going every day to the market to choose the items I needed for my house. I never expected that all of it would go with the wind.
After the bombing, they fled with Sarah's family to a shelter at a school in the central region of the Gaza Strip. They are among 1.9 million Gazans who have become displaced since the start of the war on the 7th of October. The United Nations estimates that to be 85% of the total population. Majid says he's lost more than 50 members of his family in the war, but he was determined to marry Sarah.
We celebrated in the school, of course, without drums. Sarah was wearing a black prayer dress and I wore black trousers and a black shirt.
And Majid convinced his father to officiate the ceremony.
They were determined to get married and told me the living is more important than the dead. Let's cheer up. I set an example for every father and mother to have trust in God and hasten the wedding of their sons.
Erbik Nor reporting. Polish police have arrested a former interior minister and his deputy who'd taken refuge in the presidential palace. Mariusz Kamiński and Maciej Wasik were sentenced to prison last month as part of a long-running case in which they were found guilty of abuse of power. The pair had served in the law and justice-led government that lost power in October. Poland's president, Andrzej Duda, an ally of the party, had pardoned the men. But now a court has ruled that pardon was invalid. Our correspondent in Warsaw, Adam Easton, told us why these men had sought refuge in the presidential palace.
They were invited there by President Duda, who is a former member of the Law and Justice Party and remains an ally of the Law and Justice Party, who are now in opposition, but of course who were in office for 8 years before they were voted out in October's election. Now, President Duda invited them to the presidential palace to observe a swearing-in ceremony of their former colleagues who are becoming advisers to the president. He did so after he knew that a court in Warsaw had ordered the police to detain these men so that they could start serving a 2-year prison sentence for abusing their power during an anti-corruption investigation. So President Duda has invited these men to the presidential palace and, in effect, helped them evade detention.
And it's not the first time that the president has done such a controversial thing, because one of these men was an interior minister after President Duda granted him a pardon in 2015.
Yeah, the dispute is essentially that President Duda and these men say, President Duda said, I pardoned them for these crimes in 2015. But last year, the Supreme Court in Poland said that the pardon was invalid because he had issued it before their appeal had a chance to be heard. So that is why a court last month issued a final ruling sentencing them to prison. And then, as we had the events on Monday evening, with the court then asking the police to execute the detention warrant so they could then serve their time in prison. Now, President Duda and both men say, well, no, my initial pardon in 2015 overrides or nullifies any court ruling because it is still valid. And that is the nub of the dispute. And that is why these men, in these absolutely unprecedented circumstances in politics, the saga between the two rival camps now in Polish politics, between Polish President Andrzej Duda and the new pro-EU coalition government under Donald Tusk, has escalated to unforeseen levels here with this event, and allowed these two men to go to the presidential palace and then come out and talk to reporters and say, look, we are political prisoners if we are imprisoned by the police. And then they went back into the palace, and then several hours later they were actually detained by the police and are now in detention.
Adam Easton. It's one of the biggest spying scandals to engulf longtime enemies, Cuba and the United States. A former US ambassador to Bolivia was arrested in an FBI sting operation in Miami last month for acting as a Cuban spy for more than 40 years. Manuel Rocha was secretly recorded by an undercover officer describing the US as the enemy, praising Fidel Castro, and boasting about his decades-long double life as a Cuban agent.
Over the years, Mr. Rocha would have had access to a wealth of classified and sensitive intelligence information. The US government is currently trying to assess exactly what material he allegedly passed on to his Cuban handlers while at the State Department. Will Grant reports from Havana.
Other than asking the photographers to move out of her way, Carla Witkop Rocha said little to the media as she left court in Miami. Inside court, her husband, the former US ambassador to Bolivia, Manuel Rocha, had just been charged with working for four decades as a secret agent for Cuba. The US Attorney General, Merrick Garland, described the case against Mr. Rocha as one of the most significant of its kind.
This action exposes one of the highest-reaching and longest-lasting infiltrations of the US government by a foreign agent.
150 kilometers away, in Havana, the case of Manuel Rocha has gone almost unreported.
During his career, Manuel Rocha worked as the number two in the building in front of me, the US Embassy in Havana, or, as it was back then, the US Interest Section. To many observers, it remains extraordinary that Mr. Rocha could have risen so high in the US diplomatic service while allegedly working for Cuba. Apparently a brazen example of hiding in plain sight by disguising his true beliefs under a facade of right-wing conservatism. But one man who wasn't entirely surprised is James Olson, former chief of counterintelligence at the CIA.
I rank them as probably the most aggravating service I've ever worked against.
He told me there's a common misconception that Cuba's intelligence services were weakened after the fall of the Berlin Wall and when the KGB stepped back.
I consider the Cubans more disciplined and more effective pound for pound than the KGB ever was. They've surpassed the KGB in terms of tradecraft and motivation and resistance to penetration.
For its part, Cuba has made no comment about Manuel Rocha, his arrest, or the charges that he's facing in Miami. But whenever the subject of spying or spycraft is discussed, Cuba's basic position is this, that it's been forced to use all the methods at its disposal to defend the revolution from more than 60 years of successive US administrations hell-bent on forcing the communist-run government from power.
One of Cuba's most famous spies is a man called Gerardo Hernández. Leader of a group known as the Cuban Five, the men infiltrated anti-Castro Cuban-American organizations in Florida in the 1990s. He was arrested in 1998 on conspiracy to commit espionage charges and spent 16 years in prison before being released as part of a prisoner swap during the Obama-era thaw with Havana. In an exclusive interview, Gerardo Hernández told me he considers his covert operations in the US to be a crucial part of the defense of the Cuban Revolution.
The US, a country that has a list of alleged countries that sponsor terrorism, and they have Cuba on that list, paradoxically, they are the ones that have their terrorists in their territory operating against Cuba. So Cuba had no choice but to seek for that kind of information to protect our country.
Is it going on now, the same kind of work that you did? Are there people doing that work now around the world and in the United States?
Well, you know, I retired a long time ago. I couldn't tell that for sure. But all I can say, if right now there are still people plotting to do terrorism against Cuba, most probably there are going to be Cuban patriots seeking for information to protect our country.
For former CIA chief James Olson, it still bothers him that, by his own admission, Cuba's intelligence services got the better of him.
They owned us. They beat us. And that's one of the reasons I have this personal grudge against the Cuban intelligence service, because they have been so successful in operating against us.
You fully admit they won that battle, as it were.
No question about it. I don't like to lose to a foreign intelligence service, but they did it. They're good, really good.
For now, Manuel Rocha is yet to enter a plea. The trial in Miami is set to continue soon and will be one of the most keenly followed espionage cases in the long history of spying between Washington and Havana.
That report by Will Grant in Cuba. Still to come.
It's Friday night and I'm in the red light district in Amsterdam. Surrounding me are dozens of sex workers posing behind windows and doors illuminated by red neon lights.
Now there are plans to relocate the prostitutes from the Dutch city's famous area to an out-of-town mega brothel.
Some people play golf on the weekends. I hunt con artists.
Unmissable podcasts from the BBC World Service.
Are County Mayo a great team blighted by mystical forces we can't comprehend?
I believe in the curse. I think it's real.
Telling stories from around the globe.
Every minute there's bombing and shelling. There is no safety. If I get any internet connection, I'll talk to you again.
Search for Lives Less Ordinary, Amazing Sports Stories, and The Documentary, wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
You better be ready, because we're going to bring it.
Canada's top investigative consumer program has helped you avoid clever scams, uncover unsafe products, and exposed sketchy services. It returns to help keep you safe and save you money. CBC Marketplace has got your back. Watch free on CBC Gem.
Welcome back to the Global News Podcast. As we heard in an earlier edition, European Union climate monitors say last year was the hottest on record. In fact, probably the hottest in the last 100,000 years. The Copernicus Climate Change Service report said heat waves, droughts and wildfires had intensified across the planet as global temperatures in 2023 came close to crossing the critical threshold of 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels. Last year saw wildfires across Canada, severe droughts in East Africa and the Middle East. In Europe, the United States and China, there were unprecedented summer heat waves, and Australia and South America saw their warmest ever winters. Global warming is making all these phenomena more likely, posing a challenge for governments everywhere. Ione Wells has this assessment from Sao Paulo in Brazil.
Last year, Brazil saw its highest ever temperature, 44.8 degrees Celsius, and the staggering heat waves had a significant impact on people's health and the environment. A severe drought in the Amazon led to fish and animal carcasses washing up on the riverbanks. A fan died of heat exhaustion after passing out at a Taylor Swift concert in Rio. Unlike his predecessor, Jair Bolsonaro, President Lula is reducing deforestation and introducing more ambitious climate targets. He hosted a summit of mostly left-wing rainforest nations in August to discuss ways of addressing the crisis and protecting the region often referred to as the lungs of the world. But Lula is also under pressure to deliver economic growth and has been criticised for backing new oil drilling in the Amazon. Trying to strike this balance is a challenge also facing leaders in parts of Africa, as my colleague in Kenya, Anne Soy, explains.
Here in the Horn of Africa, five consecutive seasons of failed rains caused prolonged drought, which left at least 50 million people across the region hungry. Harder communities lost livestock, their main source of livelihood. But when the rains finally came, they caused more devastation in the same region. Hundreds of people died in floods, farmlands and towns were submerged, and infrastructure like bridges and roads destroyed. Major economic setbacks to an already fragile region. African nations are said to be among the most vulnerable to the effects of climate change, despite contributing least to it. Over now to my colleague Laura Bicker in Beijing.
China's big problem is coal. The country has more coal-fired power stations than anywhere else in the world, and it's still investing in fossil fuels. This addiction to coal means China accounts for around a third of the world's greenhouse gas emissions each year. But as well as being one of the world's biggest polluters, China is also the front runner when it comes to offering the world climate solutions. It's building more solar panels and wind turbines than the rest of the world combined. China now controls more than 80% of the world's solar panel manufacturing. This push towards renewables is plugging energy gaps in parts of rural China, and CO2 emissions are set to fall this year.
Laura Bicker, and before her we heard from Anne Soy and Ione Wells. So given all these concerns, I asked the BBC's climate editor, Justin Rowlatt, what governments are doing to try to avert a potential climate disaster.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because obviously I followed the COP28 meeting in Dubai just before the new year. And we saw what looked like a breakthrough countries agreeing for the first time ever of the need to transition away from fossil fuels. Fossil fuels are the main driver of the emissions that are increasing global temperatures. So that is progress. But on another way of looking at it, after 28 of these global meetings, it's also a measure of our failure, isn't it? That after so long, we've only just acknowledged the main driver of climate change needs to be tackled. So on the one hand, countries are getting together and saying, look, we need to tackle this problem, acknowledging it. And these are countries, remember, that have dragged their feet in the past. Countries like Saudi Arabia, like Russia, India, all these countries have been very reluctant to make any commitments. So, look, it is good. But at the same time, we absolutely are not doing enough.
I mean, there has been huge investment in renewables, particularly in China, for instance. But if we don't do enough, what does this mean for the future of our children and our grandchildren?
That is not a question that it's pleasant to answer. When you put carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, it stays there for hundreds, sometimes for thousands of years. It's a stock. It's not a flow. It doesn't come out easily. So we're building it. It's like we're increasing the blanket around the Earth that creates this greenhouse effect. So we will drive up temperatures. It's quite hard once you've put the gas in there to take it out again. So probably permanently. And it won't stop rising until we stop increasing emissions. So what does that mean for the future? Well, until we stop emitting carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases, temperatures will continue to rise. And we're already seeing the impact, aren't we, around the world? The heat waves that we saw last year, the extreme storms that we've seen, all of these things are consequences of climate change. They're actually happening more dramatically even than climate scientists expected. So we should expect more of those. What impact will that have? Well, it makes life a bit harder, particularly in areas where, for example, agriculture is quite marginal already. It makes it that little bit harder, makes people more likely to want to maybe move somewhere else in the world. So we can expect an increase in migration. We can expect countries to experience more food insecurity, more water insecurity, all of things which actually, when you think about it, make it harder for them to make bold kind of intergovernmental decisions about tackling something like climate change. So it is worrying, and it means we're not going to all die out suddenly, but it means life could be a little bit harder for the generations to come.
Justin Rowlatt, well, despite all these fears for the future, Norway has become the first country in the world to open up part of its seabed for mining, despite warnings of the possible environmental impact. The government approved a bill which will allow companies to apply to extract precious minerals from the seabed. Molly Perella reports.
The materials are key for producing green technologies, including batteries, but environmentalists say mining them from the seafloor could have a catastrophic impact on marine life in the area and contribute to climate change. Despite that, Norway's parliament approved the bill with 80 votes in favour and 20 against. The plan will see a large area of Norwegian waters, bigger than the UK, opened up for mining. But Norway says it won't issue any licences until further environmental studies are carried out. There is currently no timetable for when the project could begin.
Molly Perella. Now, let's go to the Netherlands, where there are plans to relocate prostitutes from Amsterdam's famous red light district away from the city centre to an out-of-town mega brothel. But there have been objections from people who think the red light district is an important tourist attraction. City councillors will now debate the new site. If approved, it would take 7 years to build, as Suzanne Byrne reports.
It's Friday night and I'm in the red light district in Amsterdam, where amongst the canals and cobble streets and wonky buildings, surrounding me are dozens of sex workers posing behind windows and doors illuminated by red neon lights. However, plans are in place to relocate many of the sex workers to a purpose-built erotic centre on the outskirts of Amsterdam. Mayor Femke Halsema wants to stop the noisy and unruly behaviour of tourists in the red light district. David Ruttle lives there and says it can be difficult to live with sometimes.
I don't mind being in a kind of living, beating heart of a city and hearing what's going on. I mean, you will have people just screaming for literally no reason in the middle of the night, which can be a bit disturbing at times.
Mayor Halsema is also concerned about the levels of crime and the vulnerability of the women who work there, many of whom she says are foreign. But the plan isn't being welcomed by many sex workers, residents and campaigners. Mariska Mayor is the founder of the Prostitution Information Centre. A former sex worker herself, she says the red light district is an important part of Amsterdam.
The sex industry, the window brothels and all the red light is really important, a really important part of our neighbourhood You know, I always call the red light district like one square kilometer part of Amsterdam in which everything is happening that you can find in life. And window prostitution, I can understand for some people it's a difficult thing to understand, but it's a very important part of our city culture.
She says many sex workers don't want to move away.
That there's a big difference in working in the window on the street and being part of a society, a living area, which is the Red Light District, and working somewhere indoor. It's darker, it has a different atmosphere. When you go outside after work, it will be dark and quiet on the street, so I think I would feel very unsafe.
There's now a petition against the plan led by Theodor van Boeven, co-owner of Condomerie, a condom shop in the Red Light District. He says it's not about protecting his business.
We have so many different clients, and we are not depending on the sex workers here. No, we have this neighborhood here, Red Light District, is so interesting. It's so high and low life together. They have to solve the problems like crowd control and antisocial behavior.
As I wander around the Red Light District, I ask people who live there what they think of the city's plans to rehouse the area's sex industry.
Hi, I'm Saskia. I think it's good in terms of tourism and disturbance and rubbish, but in terms of like working and employment for the people actually working here, I don't think it's a good move.
My name is Sharon Hewitt. It's not my idea of doing that, and it's definitely the charm and the excitement of this part of town. I don't think that solves the problem. Absolutely not. It should be solved by more police in the street to take care of the people that are going to see them.
A final decision on the future location of the Red Light District is expected later this year. But with so much resistance so far, it's unlikely to go down without a fight.
That was Suzanne Byrne reporting from Amsterdam. Let's turn to India now, and one of the biggest names in Indian classical music, Rashid Khan, has died. He was 55 and had been battling cancer. Sanjay Dasgupta looks back on his life.
This was the signature voice of Indian classical music in the 21st century, a voice that enchanted millions and had become in its own way an instantly recognizable brand. Rashid Khan learned his craft in the way Hindustani classical music has been passed down the generations for 700 years, inheriting the tradition from his granduncle Nisar Hussain Khan, one of the most prominent names of his era. In time, Rashid Khan's fame as a classical vocalist far surpassed his teachers. His concerts sold out overnight, his recordings sold by the tens of thousands. His popularity and stardom rivaled those of screen personalities. No mean feat for a performer brought up in the arcane confines of the classical tradition. But for millions of Ustad Rashid Khan's fans, it was not the stardom that mattered. It was the voice, the sheer enchantment of that deep, mellifluous baritone, twisting, turning, dancing through the notes with the audacity and grace of a soaring bird in flight.
Sanjay Dasgupta reporting on the life of the celebrated music maestro Rashid Khan, who has died at the age of 55. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Caroline Driscoll. The producer was Liam McSheffrey. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Janet Jalil. Until next time, goodbye.